Welcome to Real Money Radio, the show that focuses on real people, real problems, and real solutions. Here's your host, certified financial planner, David Holland.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, welcome back. And so let me say that I'm very excited about today's program because, you know, this is a big world we live in, and there's stuff happening all over the globe, but it all is interrelated. That's what they say, at least. I'm a believer of that. So we're going to dive into some of what's happening around the world, specifically a couple of countries that have been very much in the news of late: Russia, China, Brazil. And to help us out, an expert in those areas, or certainly, at the very least, very well tuned into those countries and visiting them and all of that, is Kenneth Raposa. He is an executive contributing editor for Forbes, Forbes.com, and we're really glad to have him on the program, senior emerging markets reporter, and he has been a reporter with the mainstream media for 17 years, including 10 years stint in Brazil. For the Boston Globe and the Wall Street Journal, licensed as a broker in the past, but opted to focus on the media, and you'll see why. He's very tuned into this. So he's just back from Russia. That sounds like a movie or something. Kenneth, welcome to the program.
How you doing? Thanks for having me on.
I'm very glad to have you on. And so you just got back from Russia, a big conference over there, and I hear that it was standing room only, or you had to be stacked double deep, double wide, and all to talk to Putin and find out what's going on in this country that perhaps is turning the corner. What do you think?
Well, yes, I went to the annual Russia Calling Conference. This is a big investor forum put on by VTB Capital, which is one of the banks sanctioned by the U.S. and European Union over the political battle happening in Ukraine as we speak. So
sure.
It was quite a crowd, and it's an impressive crowd because this year in particular with sanctions, and with now the latest Russian bombing of Syria, Russia is the headline, and Putin is the star of the show. And at this event, they get to speak with Putin openly and ask him uncensored questions, and he responds. And it's interesting to see investors from CalPERS, which is a big California state pension fund, and investors, hedge funds from Delaware Investments, and you know Lloyd's of London, and they're all there, and they're very interested in Russia. So when you hear the story of, oh, who's investing in Russia? Well, I just gave you one of the biggest pension funds in the country that's got money to work here. So I was surprised to see that many people, to be honest with you. It was quite a crowd. Double what I've seen in the previous years. I've been going to this forum now for 5 years.
Well, maybe it's an obvious question or maybe it's maybe a way of kind of looking at this is all of this new interest or renewed or increased interest because there, and you've written about this, we've been following your work and very pleased to have you come on and talk about it, that there's been a kind of a perception that Russia's economy has bottomed, or at least in some areas the declines have slowed and some of the areas have starting to pick up, and that these people are there and the interest is all about getting in on something that's down and perhaps with the future looking better for the country?
Sure, yeah, that's part of it. I would say that Russia bottoming, that's sort of what we've heard. That's what the big economists at the big banks tell the Russian government. That's what the Russian government reiterates. I spoke to some portfolio managers on the sidelines, and they say the same thing. But what I can gather from the people I spoke to in the investment community, both in the U.S. and in Moscow, is that it's hit bottom, but it's sort of, as I've written in Forbes, it's sort of dragging around like a scalloper at the bottom of the sea. You know what I mean? We're not ready to hoist anything out of the water yet. We're just dragging around uncomfortably there and scraping bottom. So we had some data come out the other day. I think today, actually, industrial production numbers look a little better. But, you know, Russians are losing money. You know, things are expensive. And Moscow is expensive. It's not easy. The people I spoke to there were saying, you know, a lot of my friends have lost their jobs. And things aren't as good as they seem. So it's And they don't seem good, really. You know, I mean, the numbers aren't great. So when you're an investor looking at Russia, you can't look at this economy and say, oh, my God, it's time to put money to work. It is time to put money to work if you're a long-termer and you think that this hit bottom and things are going to turn around. But there's political risks, and it's still known as the Wild East in the emerging market. So
yeah, sure. Well, and, you know, I know that oil's movement has certainly helped to some degree, you know, courtesy of your articles with Forbes. You know, I read that 50% of Russia's exports are oil, and it's 20% of their GDP. So, You know, that's it with oil trading in the mid-40s, you know, that's certainly giving some lift there. What are you seeing in terms of their expectations for that part?
What they're doing now is this week Parliament will decide on their 2016 budget. When they first did their budget last year, they based it on $8 a barrel of oil Ooh. Collapse. Then they redid their budget in an emergency meeting, and they based everything on $60 barrel of oil. And this year they're going to base 2016's budget on a $50 barrel of oil,
okay.
which seems reasonable. Assuming
sure.
Well, this can go to 35, right?
Right,
where
right.
Where it's been, it can very well go. So, you know, this is something Russia has to deal with. I mean, Russia is just a disappointment. Because you look at Russia and you say, as Senator John McCain has said, and he's no fan of Russia, so he's not going to say anything good ever, but his line is, you know, Russia is just one big gas station. And that's kind of true. That's all it is, you know? And you look at it and you say, you know, why aren't there more Kaspersky labs? I mean, Kaspersky is a big antivirus, which is Russian. And why aren't there more of those companies? And how come when you're in, you know, the former, you know, Soviet enclaves like the Baltic states, why don't you see X5 or Magnet, the big Russian supermarkets there? I mean, you go to Latin America, and certainly the United States never invaded Brazil, but Walmart's everywhere. You know, why isn't there a Russian supermarket even in Lithuania? I didn't see any. You know,
did anybody ask him that question?
You look at that country, you say, it's just one big political machine, and oil and gas has spoiled it. It's spoiled the country. The Dutch disease, right? Everybody in Russia knows. They talk about this all the time. They've spoken about this for years. They've done nothing about it. So maybe with oil staying at 40, finally give Russia a chance to say, we got to do something about this reliance on Gazprom and Rosneft.
Well, did anybody ask Putin that when they had the little the forum you attended?
They always ask Putin that question in a roundabout way. He's not really the man to answer that. They talk about that more with the finance minister and the economic development minister. And even, you know, and they're very frank. I mean, the central banker, Elvira Nabiulina, you know, she'll come out and say, you know, we have to be less reliant on oil and gas. You know, but you know, they say this stuff all the time. They've been saying this for 5 years. And it's less of a reliance in the local economy, but when you look at the exports, it's just, you know, the numbers are staggering. It's 45%, 48% of Russia's export value comes from that sector alone. So.
Yeah, Kenneth, speak to their currency and what's been happening. Where is that, and what's been happening, and what's kind of to be expected there?
Okay. Sure. Well, if you remember last year, right around this time, when oil prices kept collapsing and sanctions were imposed on Russia, and they're getting harder to, getting harsher. At the time, let me back up. So the central bank has always had a policy of keeping the ruble within a trading band, okay? So for the 5 years I've been in and out of the country, the ruble's always been in the 30s, always. And then they decided to, because, yeah, this is a country that just collapsed from the Soviet Union in the 90s, right? So it just kind of became a market economy really like in the mid-90s, right?
Right,
right. Really early 91, 92, which is a disaster zone. And so now they're taking the ruble free float. So what happened was, around, I don't remember the exact dates, but you're looking at maybe the end of November, early December, when the central bank said, we're going fully free float with this thing. Oil prices collapse, the sanctions become more new, there's all kind of crises going on in Russia, and then the ruble goes, the central bank stops with the trading ban.
Hmm.
Now the ruble's going to 40 and 45. And all these guys start selling the ruble, thinking, oh, the central bank's going to come in and backstop this. We know it. You know, we're going to make a killing off of this. And then the central bank didn't do anything.
Wow.
Nothing. So it went to 45, 50, 60, 70 overnight, I mean, within like days. And what happened too in that process was the central bank had raised interest rates by a whopping 200 something basis points in like a 2 day period. So everybody got nervous. And then while everybody got nervous at the time, the central bank wasn't doing its usual job of backstopping the ruble. So people got nervous. They thought the market was, they thought that the government was worried about the economy more than the investment community was worried about it. They started selling rubles, hoping some of them currency guys, hoping that maybe the central bank would come in and save them. It never did. So it got worse. But then when you look at the rubles today, even though it weakened from 35 to 71 to the dollar seemingly overnight, certainly within a 2 month period, if I remember right, it's now in the 60s and holding steady, right?
Yeah,
it's been in the 60 trading range for a while. So you could look at the currency and say, hey, it's over the last 10 months, it's
Cut in half.
It withstood the pressure of, you know, the bad news on oil and you know, oil prices going, you know, being where they were. It's tracked oil pretty religiously, as it always does, but it hasn't hasn't stayed in the 70s.
Okay.
It stayed pretty steady in the 60s. So will it stay there? I don't know. I don't know. You know, I think it will. If oil stays where it is, oil goes to 30, then, you know, the ruble goes to 70s, right?
Yeah. Well, I tell you what, we'll have to keep tabs on that and watch that. If you're just joining us, Kenneth Raposa is our guest, and you can see why we invited him, right on the money and tuned into what's happening. We're going to grab a quick break, and we'll come right back, and we're going to talk about China and Brazil. We're going to get to it. Stay right there.
Retirement planning doesn't have to be hard, complicated, or stressful. It also doesn't have to be done in a hurry or with sales pressure. Since starting Holland Financial in 1997, it has been David Holland's mission to help individuals, couples, and families plan their futures with personalized financial planning. David puts himself in his client's shoes and recommends products and services he would choose for himself or his family. If you'd like to learn more about Holland Financial or to schedule a one-on-one consultation with David, simply call 671-PLAN. That's 671-PLAN. No cost or obligation. Or visit planstronger.com.
And welcome back. Okay, so Kenneth Raposa is on the line with us, fresh back from Russia, but we're going to send him back overseas, at least in the conversation, to talk with a little bit about China. Kenneth is executive contributing editor for Forbes.com, and I'm very happy to have him with us talking about some of these overseas events and activities, countries and whatnot, because it all affects us right here in the United States. So, Kenneth, China, you know, the red dragon in the room. We can't ignore China, and there's, as it relates to a whole range of things, but I wanted to hit on one of the things I know that you wrote about back in September. Was the Federal Reserve and China Matters. And I want to, you know, dive in there a little bit, and then you can give us kind of an overview of what you're seeing with your perspective on China. So for the listeners, why does China matter for the Federal Reserve and its interest rate policy setting?
I think it matters for the Federal Reserve and the interest rate policy setting in the sense that China is a big commodity buyer. Mm. And so if commodities are no longer faced with the demand of the Chinese economy, then that means commodity prices fall, dollar gets stronger.
Sure.
And stronger dollar, you know, for the Fed, you know, makes, you know, it just kind of lets them think we shouldn't be raising interest rates because the dollar is strong enough as it is. If we raise it, it might get even stronger. And so it makes the, you know, U.S. exports more, you know, less competitive and so on. But
right.
I think what we're looking at really is I'm not an expert on U.S. monetary policy by any stretch of the imagination, but the fact that China demand is down, it makes commodities weak, and that's something that the Fed looked at. People didn't think that. People didn't think that the Fed would actually come out and say external factors, and of course that meant China. I don't remember the exact quote, but I don't think anyone really felt that the Fed would hold rates where they were in September because of external factors, meaning China really...
It is remarkable. Yep. It is remarkable. And, you know, I just saw a headline that flashed across, and I haven't had a chance to go in and dig into it, but it looked like a CNBC headline that, no, Bloomberg, I'm sorry, Bloomberg, that Bloomberg reported China selling a lot of U.S. debt. And so they're selling some of what they hold on the open market. Do you see the story? You make much of that?
No, I did not.
Okay. So, I mean, obviously, they're one of the top one or two. I think they're number two behind Japan, holding of our U.S. debt. And, you know, that of course, could be if somebody need to raise cash or whatever they need to do. But with what you said, Kenneth, I think that's really interesting that, you know, that the Fed is, I mean, and I think they should, obviously, they need to look at everything going on. It's such an interrelated world. They can't ignore China and, you know, the commodities consumption. And they're still trying to orchestrate this centralized governance of this movement toward capitalism. And, you know, so it's going to be very interesting to see how China really is able to navigate.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting to see how China navigates. Everybody wants to see how China navigates. I was talking to the chairman of Hang Lung Properties, which is a big Hong Kong real estate developer. His name is Ronnie Tan. He's one of the richest guys in China, certainly one of the richest in Hong Kong, if not one of the top 10. And, you know, he told me that, you know, he doesn't think that the government really has a handle on transition. It's tough what they're doing. I certainly have no idea exactly how they're going to do it. I'm not going to pretend I do. Of course, you can talk to some anti-China guys. They know exactly what's going on.
Right,
all
of course.
All over the news. But I really do not, and the people I talk to, you know, don't, including some fund managers, Chinese fund managers in Hong Kong and Shanghai. But I think on a whole, that, you know, people who have to be in China, you know, these big mandated emerging market funds, right? They have faith. They have faith that Beijing will get it right. You know, they have faith that Beijing will get it right. But how they do it, you know, I don't know. What's happening in China right now, basically, right? You have an economy that doesn't want to be the low-cost manufacturer and export economy that it was before.
Right.
It's trying to become more entrepreneurial.
Right.
It's trying to become more green because it has to, because pollution
right.
in the major cities is a
it's
disaster.
Crazy.
And all these things are creating new market opportunities in China, you know. But nobody really knows how that's going to play out. So it becomes a world where years ago, if somebody was going to buy China, they'd paint it with a broad stroke, and they'd buy an ETF like, you know, the iShares FTSE China or maybe the new Deutsche Bank A-Share Fund ETF. And now they're, you know, fund managers now are looking at it more in terms of sectors and stock picking and trying to pick winners. And based on how China is going to run their five-year plan and where they're going to throw money, which, of course, is going to be in environmental-friendly businesses, which is very important for them. It's going to be maybe even punishing the non-environmental friendly business like coal and maybe even airlines because it pollutes because of diesel and jet fuel. So, you know, these are things that people are looking at closely. And at the same time is that, you know, they look at exporters and these guys are going to be moving more to India, which we're seeing happening now. So it's a different world for China. I don't think anybody thinks China's going to go at 7% anymore.
No.
So.
Well, you know what's interesting, Kenneth?
People think that China is still going to be the 10% growth country, then, you know, they're sadly mistaken. I don't think people think that. No one I talk to thinks that anymore.
Well, you know what's interesting, Kenneth, is one of the things you mentioned kind of at the front of that is talking to the, you know, the wealthy Hong Kong business person. You know, the thing that struck me is if the government of China doesn't have or the perception is perhaps that they don't completely have their arms around or complete control over it, then they just might have some real entrepreneurship and some real capitalism. Because if they can't quite control it, they might actually be getting real capitalism, because that's, you know, a little part of the recipe, you know, of how that works. So it will be interesting to see how that develops, because there's so much there, and they've got so much to factor in to make these transitions, and you spoke to they're no longer the low-cost provider. You know, you talked about that as well in one of your articles. A lot of that's going to India, and the made in China tag, we may not see that as often as we used to on our clothing.
Right, yeah, and to speak to what you just said about, you know, maybe that, because they don't really have a firm grasp on it, maybe that opens the door more for an entrepreneurial society. That might be true, but that might be wishful thinking, because on the other hand, the government is sort of being, you know, more, not heavy-handed, that's not the right word, I can't think of the right word, but they're being more, you know, Xi Jinping, he's very much a controlling figure, you know what I mean?
Right,
he's very much a party man. So he's not necessarily saying, hey, you know, let's go have more, let's make sure we build more Jack Ma's. I mean, yeah, we want more Jack Ma's, we want more Alibaba types. Of course, they do want that. But at the same time, it's still very much a controlled from the top economy, and there's no signs that that I've seen that that's not going to remain for the foreseeable future.
Well, that's what we'll have to watch to see how they do it. Kenneth
Proposa,
ladies and gentlemen, and we'll grab another quick break. Come back with our executive contributing editor, Forbes.com, right after this quick break.
Since 1997, David Holland has built a solid reputation in our local community as an independent financial advisor. Just as important, Holland Financial's professional team has grown to include 3 experienced certified financial planners, a tax accountant, an attorney, 3 chartered financial consultants, accredited asset management specialists, and certified annuity specialists. Our attentive and professional staff gives prompt and individualized attention to each and every one of our clients. Count on Holland Financial for your financial advice, not only for today, but for many years to come. Call Holland Financial at 671-PLAN or visit us online at planstronger.com. Do you have financial questions you'd like answered on this show? Send them to questions@planstronger.com. You will remain anonymous.
Hey, we're back. Kenneth Raposo on the line with us and giving us our money's worth, I'll say that, on Russia, then China. Now we got to go to Brazil and make the most of Kenneth's perspective and experience, executive contributing editor for Forbes, Forbes.com. And so, South America, Brazil. What's happening in Brazil?
Poor Brazil. This is the country I know the best because I've lived there for so long. Let me give you my overview of Brazil.
All right. You have it.
You can't predict the bottom.
Interesting.
You know, Mark Mobius said today, he's the famous emerging market frontier guy from Franklin Templeton.
Right.
And he said in an article I read today that, you know, now it's time to buy Brazil. Mm. But I have to tell you that about 6 months ago, I guess it was now, time flies, we did a story for Forbes magazine, about a well-known Brazilian fund manager, one of the only female fund managers there who runs this big broker-dealer in Sao Paulo, who said the same thing, you know.
Oh,
Brazil
yeah.
kind of hit the bottom, you know what I mean? Yeah. We're near it, and it was just months later, just getting worse, you know.
Yeah.
So we were thinking that the Brazilian real, the currency there, wouldn't be hitting 4-1 anytime soon, or if it did, it would go back pretty quickly. And now Brazil, the real seems like it's firmly entrenched in the high 3s, low 4s for the time being.
Yeah.
The political crisis there continues to undermine any shot of reform. Reporters are still asking if the finance minister, Joaquim Levy, is going to resign or not.
Yeah,
you know, I call Brazil the Latin American Greece, you know, not in sense of its debt, certainly not. Brazil is, you know, wealthier in that regard, not on a per capita basis, of course not, but in terms of the government and the money it has, cash machine it has there to pay its debt, unlike Greece. But in terms of the political story, you know,
right.
which Greece was always, you know, is this guy going to do this? And then it would be, yes, he is. And then you find out the day later that, no, he's not going to do that after all. And it was always this sort of back and forth, like a soap opera. And that's what, like a really bad one, too. And that's what Brazil has become, sadly. I don't see that changing anytime soon. So
there's a price for all that, right?
I think that it's a problem. It's a big problem. If you're an investor there, do you go, because, oh, it's such a disaster. Maybe, you know, Brazil is a big, diverse economy. I'm going to dive in as an equity, you know, as an equity play, equity investment. But what happens is a week or two later, some new allegation comes out or some new charge comes out in the Brazil Petrobras scandal and
gets worse. Yeah, it gets worse. Well, there's a price to all this. Again, courtesy of one of your recent articles, Fitch downgraded Brazil to one notch above junk. That's BBB-. That is not good for managing their debt and the cost of that debt long term and their ability to strengthen their economic and all of their obligations and entitlement programs that are pretty rigidly in place. So that, you know, there is a price.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah, it is. Brazil years ago, it's not the 90s anymore.
No, it's not.
It's certainly not the 80s where almost all Brazil's debt was, not all of it, but a good portion of it was foreign. Okay, so Brazil doesn't have huge dollar-denominated debts from the government standpoint. Okay, so you don't have to. I mean, that's bad. It's a problem. It makes financing a lot harder. But this isn't an economy that's tapping bond markets on a regular basis to make ends meet. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, locally it is. Locally it is. But local interest rates have been in the teens for years now.
Right.
And this is an economy that that is in the doldrums. So I don't even think. You know, I don't think Brazilian companies are looking for foreign debt right now. So, or even if they would probably even get it, you know what I mean? So, maybe they would because of yields they'd be able to offer. But still, biggest problem with Brazil right now is that these investment grade reductions for Brazil just sort of give investors a bad taste of Brazil.
Yeah. Well, compared to other countries, it's always, everything's always relative to something else. So, compared to the other countries in South America, I mean, that, do they seem, still be stronger than some?
Yeah, South America has really gone downhill over the last 2 years, hasn't it? Venezuela is a disaster.
Argentina.
Venezuela has kind of been in rough shape for a long time anyway, and certainly was not friendly to markets. So there you go, Chavez. Argentina, the same. And then you have Chile, which is just such a small market. It's not something anyone looks at. Really, it was always for the attention of investment managers, it was always a battle between Brazil and Mexico, and now Mexico is winning that battle, whereas Mexico is much more attractive if you have to put money in Latin America because of Mexico's relation with the United States. And Brazil is a diverse economy, but it's an economy that you can't call the bottom on it right now. It's an economy that's in a political crisis, and so it makes it very difficult to say whether Brazil is a good place to be looking at right now.
Well, I can
tell you. I think it is. I think it is because it's so cheap. But you have to be someone who has a long-term horizon, right? I mean, if I had thousands of dollars I didn't know what to do with right now, I'd be pumping it into Petrobras. And if it went to $3 a share, I'd pump it back because I don't think this company is going to go under suddenly. And I think that it's a $10 stock. And it might take 2 years to get there, but I'm going to double or triple my money. But you got to be patient. You can't be scared when it goes down to $3, it goes down to $4.50 and be yelling at your broker because you told me it was the bottom because, you know, anything can happen with that stock right now. And it's the same thing with Brazil. So I would, as somebody who covers, you know, financial markets and the economy in Brazil, I would say this is a story where it's very, like I said, it's very much like Greece, where you just don't know what a politician is going to say or what the Supreme Court is going to rule on or what an auditing board is going to, you know, rule on. And it just changes the news flow in Brazil, and it's always bad.
Yeah, it never gets better.
Always bad. Yeah.
Never better news. Kenneth Raposa, ladies and gentlemen. Executive contributing editor for Forbes.com and lots of great stuff at Forbes over there. Kenneth just keeps writing and writing and writing. We're out of time, Kenneth, but I thank you very much and we'll have to do it again soon. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. Have a good afternoon.
Today's edition of Real Money Radio has been brought to you by Holland Financial, conveniently located on Granada Boulevard in Ormond Beach. Could you benefit from a one-on-one confidential conversation with David Holland, or would you like a second opinion to make sure that you're on the right track? Call Holland Financial at 671-PLAN or visit us at planstronger.com to schedule your no-obligation consultation. David looks forward to discussing the financial issues that matter most to you. The host of Real Money Radio, David Holland, is a certified financial planner with over 20 years of experience. And because David provides advice to clients on a daily basis, his hyperactive compliance department wants us to tell you that David Holland is an investment advisor representative of Holland Advisory Services, a registered investment advisory firm. He offers insurance and annuity products through Holland Insurance Services. Commentary given during this radio program should not be considered investment, insurance, tax, or legal advice. Views expressed concerning specific securities are not an offer to buy or sell. Investment advice and planning services can only be given after an analysis of an individual situation and only where Holland Advisory Services is registered or exempt from registering. Real Money Radio is produced by Holland Productions.